My name is Hatsi. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm an addict too. Thank you for asking me to speak. It's always an honor. It's much appreciated. And in thinking about what I'm going to talk about, I just usually like to start with telling you how my life is today. What happened as a result of this program? What happened as a result of doing the steps, of hanging around with you guys, of not drinking, not using? What happened? Well, what happened was that my life changed in a way that I didn't think was possible. I live a lifestyle that, had I looked at it years ago, and I would have seen somebody living the life I live, I would have called it privileged or anything like that. I would have, for one thing, impossible for a guy like me. I liked to steal. I could not tell the truth. And I loved getting high and drunk, preferably on your dime. So to live my life as I live it today is a gift in all aspects, in everything I do. I live in a great home, beautiful house. I have a son who's 33 years old. By the grace of God, he's got 8 months of clean and sober. I have been given the gift to set my affairs straight with my parents before they died. I was there when my twin sister died and held her hand. I've been able to make up with my son, to tell him I'm sorry, and to receive the love he has for me and the love I feel for him. I got married 2 years ago, to my great surprise, and I'm still married today. But that's no surprise. If you know Karen, that's no surprise. But I never thought I would get married. I wasn't good at anything that's meant forever. You know, I like the whole idea of one day at a time, dating as well. That was fine with me. You know? I once told a fiancé of mine, I had a few of them, that I would like to sleep with somebody else, but I'll do it tomorrow, just not today. I thought that was real funny. But it didn't go over well. I was using the program in all my, you know, anyway, whatever. But, so my life, I have a great life. The things that I call problems today, I never thought could be problems. You know, they wouldn't even be my wildest dreams. And there's one specific thing through all of this. Everything that I value, everything that's worth anything in my life, anything, came in sobriety. None of it was there before. So I've got some years. You know, I've got some time in this program. And seeing the result of what it's done to me and what it's done to all of us and people that I hang out with, I don't question how it works. You know, I do the simple things that I was asked to do when I showed up. Actually, when I came in, I was given a promise that if I did 5 things on a daily basis, that if I did those 5 things, I would be granted sobriety for that day, guaranteed. And they are: I go to meeting, I do steps with a sponsor, I'm part of a fellowship, and I pray and meditate. Those are the 5 things. All those things I've learned in meetings. That's why people say meeting makers make it. They only make it if you do the rest of this stuff. You know, meetings is just not enough, but it starts all in meetings, and it ends there. So do those 5 things. Now, I've done those 5 things today, and I'll do them tomorrow. The odds are pretty good I'm going to stay clean and sober tonight. You know, tomorrow I have another meeting at 7 o'clock. You know, I'll do the other things. I start my day in the morning with a little bit of yoga, then I meditate for about an hour. I go to work, and I feel great. And my mind's at ease. It's at peace. What a gift. I never, ever, ever had anything close to that. So I don't argue with how it works. You know, I don't try to reinvent the wheel. I don't try to figure out what works better. I just don't. And I keep doing it. And year after year, I've been going to meetings. I've worked with a sponsor who has a sponsor. I've got sponsees. And I do the simple suggestions that I was taught way in the beginning to do on a daily basis. When I picked up a white chip, there was a guy called David. This is in Houston, Texas. I picked up a white chip, and this guy, David, was there, and he gave me a white chip, and he said, Do you think you can come back tomorrow and stay clean and sober tonight? And you know what? Nobody ever asked me that. Nobody ever asked me if I could stay clean and sober just for the evening and show up tomorrow. I've been in psychiatric hospitals. I've been in therapeutic communities. I've been in halfway houses, three-quarter-way houses. I've seen more psychiatrists. That's good for 10 lifetimes. I mean, forget it. I always had to promise things that had nothing to do with my sobriety. And this guy just asked me a simple question. You think you can come back tomorrow and stay clean and sober tonight? It was an evening meeting. Started at 8, ended at 9. I was out there at 9:30. The next day was not too far off. It was a horizon that I could envision. And for my thought, I thought, you know what? Who knows? Maybe I can. So I said, okay, I'll try it. He said, good, I'll see you tomorrow at the same meeting. And I showed up the next day. I went home. And I remember drinking coffee a lot. I smoked 2 packs of cigarettes. I probably kicked the dog. Whatever. I didn't sleep. I know that. And I showed up the next day. Pissed off, resentful, unhappy. And just absolutely miserable. But I was there. And he said, you think you can do it again? And I got cheated into doing this. Cheated doing this one day at a time. And that's the gift that it's given me. It's today. And it still is today. It still works just now. And why is it important to me? Because I'm not a guy that... I was never able to say, I'll never do that again. You know, I'll never use again. I'll never drink again. Or I had to make a promise that I'll believe in Jesus for the rest of my life. I'll do this. I believe in Allah, voodoo, whatever. None of that came to pass. I didn't have to do anything. Just show up and listen. And then he gave me some other little suggestions. But the key is this. The key is that I figured out or gave myself the option that is all the stuff that I mentioned earlier that came in sobriety, all that stuff that I like, that is valuable, that is worthwhile for me, if all that gets taken away, I'll use tomorrow. I'll drink tomorrow. I will. And I give myself that option. I give myself that opportunity. Why? Because it just works for me. Because I will not do it today. That's a given. It will not happen today. And there have been times that I got close to doing it today. I caught my girlfriend cheating on me. It hurt more than anything else. You know, when my parents died in a car crash, my twin sister left me. You know, when other friends died here in this program. Well, you know, when I stubbed my toe, or I had a feeling, God forbid, you know. But the thing is this, things sometimes were so difficult, so hard, that I could not imagine that I was going to be able to take things off. I just wanted the pain to go away. But it was going to happen tomorrow, not tonight. And that's how that thing for one day at a time works for me. And it still does. It's a little trick, I know it is, but it works for me. Because I cannot, and I just don't like the whole idea of saying, I will never do it again. And I don't know what's it for you, but that's what it is for me. I don't like that whole idea. I grew up in the Netherlands, in Holland, in The Hague and in Amsterdam. And I grew up in a normal family, at least from the outside looking in. From my viewpoint, it was not normal. Things happened at home that shouldn't happen to children. I was sexually abused by my mother. It was for a couple of years, and it was a very difficult time. And all I can remember is, I want to get out of here. That's my memory from home is, I want to get out of here. I want to leave. I don't belong here. I'm not part of this family. How can they? I couldn't be there. I hated, absolutely hated home. And at a very early age, like before I was a teenager, I remember dreaming at night. I would kind of rock myself to bed at night, and I would dream that I would be 18 years old. And at 18 years old, the magic thing would happen. First of all, I'd be an adult, and all my problems would go away. And secondly, I would be told that I was adopted. Because then it would make sense why things happened to me. Because it shouldn't happen to children. Not when they say that they love you. But the key of being adopted was, they would tell me what my real name was. Because how can you call somebody Hatsi? You think it's a funny name here? It's ridiculous in Holland. It's absolutely ridiculous. So I would be Johnny or Peter or Mike or Dick or whatever. You know? But not Hatsi, I mean, really. But anyway, I turned to 18 and I stayed Hatsi and I left. Way before that. But I was home, and and I felt all that happened to me at home was that I wanted to leave home. I didn't want to be part of it. I couldn't, and I felt different. I felt not part of it, and I wanted to get away, and I did. And there was always alcohol. I did a lot of other dry goods and liquid goods and all, but my last kiss was always alcohol. The first one too. And then there was a lot of stuff in between, mix it, get sick, do it again. But I remember 11 years or so, 11 year olds, we went to France. We had a house in France on an island. And everybody drinks wine in France. And my first encounter with alcohol on my own was with a whole group of people. And they have those bottles of wine there, red wine, country wine, and it's strong and it smells great and it's a little sour and it's delicious. and there were like 10 or 15 bottles on the table, and there were like a bunch of people in this bar, and my brother was there, and my sisters, and I remember taking a bottle, it's about a quart, it's a liter, and I took the bottle, I don't know why, but I know now. I drank the whole bottle, cluck, 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 cluck. And I learned three things. I learned, first of all, that I became a hero instantly. Everybody looked at me and said, yay! And I thought, yay, I'll do it again. I couldn't. Second thing I learned was that it felt warm. And it made me feel part of everybody. I wasn't the youngest anymore. I wasn't the little one anymore. I was, oh man, it was delicious. And the third thing I learned is that it tastes exactly the same coming out. So, but I didn't care. There were plenty of bottles there. That was my first encounter with alcohol. And I loved it. It did for me what I could not do for myself. The whole idea of that warm, glowing feeling and being part of the world. I had a love affair with it immediately. And then I had a love affair with all the other stuff. I remember one time I was introduced to some dry products. I was in my 14, 15 years old, whatever. I don't remember the date, but I remember the day and the moment. Why? Because it was a before and an after effect. You know, I'll date myself. I remember when Kennedy was shot. There was a before and after. I remember when the first man was on the moon. There was a before and after. 9/11, before, and there's these periods in my life where there's a before and after, specific. When I got sober, before and after. There's a before and after for that moment. I got introduced to a dry product, and I remember thinking, holy shit. There's something out there that can change the way I feel like this and not get sick. Unbelievable. It was, as far as I'm concerned, my first true spiritual awakening. God came down, kissed me on my forehead, and said, the world's going to be beautiful. And I believed him. And I remember thinking this thought, and this is the thing that I remember. I remember thinking, I don't ever want to feel different again. I remember that thought. And that's an important thought, because whatever that meant for me, I didn't know what the consequences were. I was maybe 14, 15 years old. Go 40 years later. I walk into the 101 here in Pompano Beach. And I'm coming in a little late, and there's a girl sharing at the podium. And she says that her sponsor warned her. Her sponsor had said, be careful what you think, because your life will travel in the direction of your thoughts. Aside from the fact that that's a pretty deep statement, I thought back to my childhood when I said, I don't ever want to feel different again. That's what I did. I chased it, like all of us. I chased it after that. Everything I did was to chase that thing and try it again. Find it. Wherever I went, I failed at everything else. I failed at being a son. I failed at being a brother. I failed at being a husband a couple of times. I failed at being a boyfriend. I failed at being a student. I was kicked out of every school I went to. I failed out of being a citizen. I was kicked out of England, for God's sake. I failed at everything else except finding people just like you to do the things I wanted to do with you. I could always sniff you out. You were everywhere. So, at the age of 16, 17 years old, I was In the Netherlands in the 70s, you had a system where you could go to the Dutch mental health system and get registered as an addict, which is, I registered as an addict. And the reason why is because if you register as an addict, you get free drugs, because they think that you need them, and we agreed. So I registered as an addict and got my free drugs. They weren't the best, but they were changeable. And then I entered a outside treatment facility, which didn't work. And then I rented another system. And then at the age of 20, I entered Phoenix House, a therapeutic community. Stayed there for 3 years. Came out clean and sober for 3 years and drank the day I came out. Why? I had drinking privileges. I was not an alcoholic. I was an addict. No, actually, I was an ex-addict. I still have the paper somewhere. It says, Hatzi Langer, ex-addict. I'm serious. Ex-addict. I was proud of it, too. It's like a title, you know, PhD, ex-addict. I liked it. So I could drink. I knew I drank to get high. They didn't know. In the 70s, the whole idea of cross-addiction was not very developed yet. And we were not really at big urgence to tell them about it, either, you know. They were very happy with their systems, and so were we. So anyway, that was. I came out of Phoenix House, and I drank. I became a cab driver, wrecked the car drunk, and got fired, and left the country. I did some other business, but I moved to South America. 12 years later, I'm in Houston, Texas. And I'm at the end of my road again. And like all of us, we felt the pang of desperation. You know, the knowledge that no matter what I'm going to do, it's not going to work anymore. It's just not going to work anymore. You know, there were fun times, there were funny times, there were great times, and then there was hell. You know, there were periods where I did things that I don't know how I got out of alive, and there were periods that I got so sick in public that was embarrassing. I would puke all over everybody, and you know, there were times that I would throw up in public bathrooms and find on the floor to see if I could get some of the pills that were in my stomach and see if it could, I mean, stuff like that, nasty. I shit in my pants in public, and it's like, I mean, it's stuff we do, at least I do. I don't know if you have. So I picked up a white chip and met David, who cheated me into this program. And something happened. What happened was that I got introduced to a simple, practical idea of how to do this thing without having to pick up. There is a way to do this program without having to go out. And by the grace of God, that's happened to me. For some reason, somehow, I've done the things just right, so I didn't see the need to get high or drunk again. From the beginning, it was emphasized to me that this is a practical program before, for me at least, it was a practical program before it was a spiritual program. And that was just as well, because I didn't want a spiritual program. I mean, I dropped so much acid. For me, I've done with spiritual programs. I'm serious. I mean, if they would have said you have to believe in Jesus or you have to believe in God, I would have said, forget it. I'm not interested. This is not what... I was told, do a couple of simple things. Don't use between meetings. Don't drink. Do the simple suggestions that we give you. Start reading the book. Start working the steps. Go to a meeting a day. Find a home group. Do some service. Simple things. Practical. And in the practicality of this process, a change occurred, slowly. I would have liked it to be quick, but it didn't happen quick. I first had to understand that what my problem was, and the first step made me aware that my problem is that if I put anything in my body to get high or drunk, I'm lost. And the reason why I believe is that the whole program starts with this understanding of the problem, is that if I don't know what my problem is, then how can I solve it? If I don't know where my problem originates from, then how can I find an answer? There's a little saying that I like, which says, if I'm capable to explain my problem in as least words as possible, in like 4 or 5 words. If I can tell my problem in few words, then in those few words is the solution. I'm powerless of alcohol. Well, guess what the solution is? Duh. Ain't that hard. But I was always confused. I was always confused about what my problem was. No matter where I went, no matter where I lived, and what language it was in, who I was with, I always ended up in the same trouble. Different languages, different people, different locations, same trouble. And it threw me. I don't understand. I did not understand. And I remember asking people, why is it I ended up in the same crap with everybody? And it was in AA that I was told that the common denominator was that I was there. And it sounds like it's funny, but it was like, really? You're right. Wow, it was like, it's like a revelation for me. But the confusion was that I didn't know I wanted to. I didn't want to know that I was there. Because if I had known what the answer was, I would have had to do something about it. So I believe that confusion is not an emotion. Confusion is a state of mind that I choose for. I choose to be confused about something so that I will not get to the answer. Because if I get to the answer, I'm going to have to do it. And if I'm confused, hey, I don't know. I don't know what to do. I'm confused. So I can continue to do what I like to do. So today, if I'm confused about something, I ask myself, what's the answer I like least? Are you kidding me? That's usually the right answer. And then I'm not confused anymore. I'm serious. So the first step stopped my confusion. I'm not confused anymore. The second step said that the answer to my problem is not me. It's a higher power, something else. When I picked up a Y chip, there was a guy picking up a 3-month chip. And I remember thinking, how did he do 3 months? How did he do 3 months? There was a guy picking up 10 years, and I didn't even want to talk to him. But there's a 3-month guy, I was thinking, and I was going to wonder, you think that's possible? That was my higher power for that moment. And in another meeting, somebody else was saying that he had this and this happened, and he was bitching and moaning about it, but he hadn't picked up. That was my higher power. And then there was my sponsor, and then there was somebody else. It was the things that happened to me in these meetings that kept me coming back and listening and listening. And I was terrified somebody would call on me, and I would say something. I was terrified for the first year and a half. And I remember after about a year and a half, I picked up my son from school. I was married to the same woman that I didn't like. I was doing the same job that was difficult, and I was not earning a lot of money. And life was a bitch, and I was miserable. But I was miserable with me. And I'd be miserable for a long time. I knew one thing. I had no other option than to go to AA. So I just did it, and I did it. Excuse me. And this day, I drive home, and I pick up my son, and I try not to go by the bars, and try not to look around. And I realize all of a sudden, I'm feeling good. I just felt good. I just had a feeling of, I was okay inside. And truly, for the first time in my life, I felt a truly good, serene feeling without any outside products. And I remember thinking, just perhaps this thing works. Maybe there's hope. And why did that happen? It's because I did the simple things that we need to do. I did the simple things. I started doing the steps. I started doing 4 through 9 after I got past 1, my problem, past 2, the fact that I don't have the answer, past 3, which says that I have to make a decision to trust the process. That's what all that's for me, what 3 says. I have to trust that this thing works. Now look around us. Yes, this thing works. The only means I'm going to, of course this thing works. But does it work for me? I used to think I was kind of special. You know, I needed special treatment. I needed a special program with special steps from special sponsors. You know, and special care and all the special shit. And I never got anything done. Until I finally made up my mind that this thing works for me. I'm a garden variety alcoholic. I love to steal. I'm a thief. I'm a liar. I'm just like all of us. I'm no different. And if it works for you, I'm going to decide it works for me. That was my 3rd step. I decided it worked for me. And then the work came. 4 through 9. 6 steps. 3 pairs, of which the first part of each pair is something I do with myself. And what I've done with that, in the second part of the prayer, I share it with somebody else. In four, I make an inventory. And in all the treatments I've been in, all the groups, encounter groups, Gestalt, you name them, all the other systems that I've been in, nobody ever asked me to write down my resentments. Ever. And looking back on this, it's a brilliant idea. It's a brilliant thing because it puts me right there where I'm at. If I write down my resentments, because I have a disease of the attitudes. And the resentment is an attitude that says what's wrong with me is your fault. What's bothering me, you did it to me. And as long as my problem is outside of me, so is the solution outside of me. So it can't be fixed. So 4 and 5 teach me not only what my resentments are, but how did I get that resentment and how did I react to people so that the resentment got reinforced and I kept getting the same resentments or the same type of resentments, and I realized that my behavior was the net result of my attitudes. And my attitude is the net result of my emotions. And once I had that insight, I could change the way I reacted. And I shared this with a sponsor in the fifth step. And I learned that no matter what happens to me, no matter where I am in life, it doesn't matter. And there's nothing that falls out of this. No matter what happens to me, it's my fault. I caused it. Whether it's fair, just, or not, it's nothing to do with it. Because if I can take the responsibility that I caused it, then I can change it. And my life changed. I learned that the voice inside of my head that tells me to do all kinds of stupid stuff is not me. It's just a voice. It's the voice that tells me to go after the guy that cut me off and run him off the street and take my SEP and hit all his windows out. And then I get arrested. And then the voice told me to do that, right? And then I get arrested and I'm sitting in jail. And the same voice will tell me, you dumb piece of shit. Same voice. I said, wait a minute, you just told me to do this. It's not me. And it's not in my favor. That voice will get me in trouble. So I've learned how to quiet that voice. In six, it talks about these defects of characters. Which ones? The ones I found in number 4 and 5. And I learned that I can work with these defects of characters. And by understanding what my defects of characters are, I changed as a person compared to you. I became less important, which I believe is the whole idea about humility. I became humble. I came to understand that I have problems, that I have continual problems, and I'm no better than anybody else in that. So I've learned to humbly ask inside of me to free me from these shortcomings. And my mind started to quiet down. And then I had to do one final thing. I had to take care of my guilt. I had to take care of the guilt of what I've done to others and the shame of what others let do to me. And I had to make a list of all people that I had to make amends to, at least became willing in step 8. I do the process on my own, and then I went out and made the amends. I made an amend 2 or 3 weeks ago. That was something I did when I was 17, 43 years ago. I didn't know where the guy was. I found him on LinkedIn. And I didn't have his phone number, but I emailed him. And I said, I'm sorry for what I've done. And I got a good response, thank God, but that doesn't matter. What matters is that I did it. And I've been thinking about it for a long time. But these amends changed me in the way I feel about myself. And this is where the key is. There are two emotions that tell me who I am and what I am worth. Contrary to popular belief, we do not get what we are worth. We don't. I think we get what we feel we are worthy of. And what I feel I'm worthy of depends on how much guilt and how much shame is inside of me. 4 and 5, 8 and 9 deal with guilt and shame. And if I have guilt and shame inside of me, I'm guilty and I'm shameful. Whatever opportunity comes to me, I cannot take advantage of it. Because I'm not worthy. So if I have the opportunity, and I've had this opportunity many times, to get rid of my guilt and my shame, the yoke comes off. the joke goes away. And my life changed. And it's not a process of doing the step once or twice or three times or four times. I've done the steps many times. And I keep doing them. Because it keeps coming up. It keeps things, resentments that I didn't figure out before. Feelings that I didn't get over with. Amends that I didn't make yet. And still inside of me, deep down, the whole idea, I'm not worth it. You know, things are good for me. I love my life. But I'm just waiting the day it's going to disappear. Because it can't last. It can't last. So I keep working at this. I keep doing this thing. Because the day I stop, my mind takes over. And my mind will tell me how it works. And when my mind tells me how it works, it won't work. It stops. So I've done steps 4 through 9. In 10, I make my daily inventory. Make amends, and I tell you a funny story. How much time do I have? Whatever. We're good?
10 minutes.
Good. I was dating this woman in... No, sorry, I was lying. I wanted to date this woman in Miami. Her name was Gretchen, whatever. And I took her out a couple of times to go for dinner, and I was doing my thing. And it didn't work. It pissed me off, but she said, I want to take it slow, and you know, she put a whole new idea on the idea of slow. But one time, we went to dinner, and I paid with this wallet. And she said, oh, is that a new wallet? And the first thing I said was a lie. I said, no, I've had it for years. Well, what happened was I used to see this girl called Lisa, and I used to date Lisa. Actually, she was one of my fiancés. And so Lisa was gone, but I would see her every so often, and there'd be some benefits. And anyway, for Christmas, she gave me this wallet. So when Gretchen asked me, is this a new wallet? I felt like I can tell her the truth. Because then I have to say that I'm still Lisa, still there. And then she says, oh, if Lisa's still there, what I'm doing... Anyway, you get it. I could not tell the truth. So the lie sounded much better. What does she know? I'm not committed to her. I was not cheating. I mean, it was nothing. Any other citizen would have said, sure. So I go home, and I can't sleep. I'm miserable. So here I am. Here, I like this woman, and I want to date her. And I can't even be honest about a wallet, let alone my life. You know, I've got like, at the time, I had like, what, 12 years sobriety or whatever, something like that. And I thought, you know, really? And the next day, I go to the office and I call her and I said, you know, Greg, when you asked me yesterday about the wallet, I lied to you. And I got the wallet from Lisa and I should have said it and I apologize for lying to you. She says, oh, that's good. I really appreciate it. It means a lot that you're honest to me. Thank you very much. Whew, like a waterfall, the relief came over me. You know, it was over. It's gone. But we never got anywhere anyway. The relationship never blossomed. I thought this would surely do it. I still have the wallet, but I never dated her. It pissed me off. But anyway. But I learned this. I learned that I cannot have a little guilt. You know, I cannot have... There's not a little guilt. There's guilt. There's not a little shame. There's shame. And what happened to me that night when I was awake thinking about that I lied to this woman is that I felt like the Hatsi I used to be. And I realized if I'm going to feel like him, I will act like him. So that's why the 10th step is there. We do the 10th step. And we promptly admitted it. Promptly for me was overnight. Sometimes it's a year. Sometimes it's a second. It all depends how quick you want to get away from your suffering. All up to you. All up to me. But it was a big lesson. I cannot afford guilt or shame because it will make me drink again. A little rhyme that I like. And in 11, I practice meditation, and I do. I practice the art of what's called noble sitting, and it's a meditation that I love. And in 12, I give it back. When I had 6 months clean and sober, I was asked to go to New York for business. And I was very afraid to go because I had to go through the airport, on an airplane, to a hotel, and there were triggers everywhere. I love airport bars. They're the most anonymous place. You think this is anonymous? Nah. Airport bars. I love airport bars. You get sloshed and drunk and nasty, and everybody's going somewhere else. Who cares? So I had to go through the airport, get on the plane, and I love airplanes. I love drinking on airplanes. Nothing else to do. No, you drink, you fall asleep, you drink again. So, and then I had to go to New York, and you go to the hotel, and you go to the little bar in the hotel. I had to go to this meeting at the New York Mercantile Exchange in the Waldorf Astoria. And there were, at this meeting, there were thousands of people, and a lot of them I knew, a lot of them I did crazy, crazy things with. I was an institutional trader. And I remember my sponsor had said, if you go to a place where there's alcohol, before you walk in, make up your mind what you order, because when the question comes, what do you want to drink? You want to come up with the right answer. So it was a Perrier, double espresso, Diet Coke, you know, caffeine. You know, so here I am. I made the plane. I made the airport. And I made the plane. I made the hotel. And I'm at this place. This is pre-cell phones, at least for me. And I'm standing at this meeting, and there's thousands of them. And this is in this big hall. And I remember seeing there was a cloud hanging in the wall, in the hall. It was like everybody was high or drunk or something, and it was like it was going to rain any moment. It was unbelievable. I mean, everything was loud. It was like, oh my God. And I stood on the outside with my Perrier, and I felt stupid because I wanted to be part of this, and I couldn't. I didn't know how to talk to people. I mean, I was like incapacitated. And I was afraid, and I was vulnerable and nervous, and I wanted to talk to my sponsor, and I wanted to go home. But anyway, so from nowhere, this guy Richie walks up. And Richie is a crazy son of a bitch. Excuse me, crazy guy. And Richie and I did some crazy, crazy stuff. And I did a lot of business with him. Lots. And he comes up to me and he says, Hotze! Got an 8-ball of Coke and 2 hookers. Let's go. And that was perfect. My sponsor did not say, when there's cocaine and hookers, make up your mind what you're going to order. You know, he said, so I knew what I wanted. I didn't want the hookers. I'm not going to share. I just want the Coke. And then I get a bottle of whiskey. And then life is good. And then maybe I'll never come home. And before I know what happened, I hear myself answering. I said, Richie, I can't screw this up. I've got 6 months clean and sober. I can't. I'm sorry. And he didn't insist, which I'm real grateful for. He turned around. And to this day, I haven't spoken to him. He disappeared out of my life. I scared him more than he scared me. I know this now, not then. That was the first test. And I've had many afterwards. It comes from nowhere. It comes from out of the blue sky. And all of a sudden, you're going to have to make the decision. Am I going to live? Am I going to die? And if this program didn't change me from a practical participant to a spiritual participant, I would not have been able to give the answer. And the spirituality came in the process of doing these things over and over and over again until I found myself at peace with who I was and who I am. The process of self-discovery, which is what this is spirituality. What a gift. My sobriety date is the first week of July 1988. Thank you very much.
You guys like that?